struggle through a post-merger integration when you can glide through it? Why deal with the PMI integration challenges when you can overcome them even before they occur? Why move slow when you can move at pace? What are the world's leading PMI experts doing right now to achieve profit-accelerating integrations? This podcast will give you all the answers to these questions and many more. My name is Dudley Peacock, and welcome to the 100 Days and Beyond podcast. Welcome, everyone, to the latest podcast, the latest episode in 100 Days and Beyond, the podcast that highlights the journey, the day-to-day activities, and what I call the rough and tumble of the unsung heroes, of those people that are put in the throes in the middle of the integration phase. So when we do mergers and acquisitions, we often have the high flyers in the front end, the deal makers doing the deals, and then it's left to the post-merger or post-acquisition integrators to do the work. Today, we've got a really special guest. So Craig Richardson is actually on the acquisition side, and he gets involved in the integration side as an owner in different businesses. And I think that's probably the easiest way to explain it. I'm going to continue to, Craig, I'm going to go through your bio right now. But I think you probably see something that often many of the practitioners might not experience, is a difference between being part of the ownership or ownership group, owning companies, doing integrations while you own them, trying to get them a strategic alignment to why you bought them in the first place. Let's quickly go through your bio. So Craig joined Dow Schofield Watts as a partner in 2006. Prior to this, he spent 14 years at KPMG undertaking corporate finance and due diligence assignments in the UK and overseas after qualifying as a chartered accountant in 1992. He has over 25 years experience advising SME owners with finance, raising, acquisition, and exit. In the inaugural Northwest Insider Awards, Craig was voted Corporate Finance Advisor of the Year and Dealmaker of the Year in Lancashire. That's brilliant. I mean, we're going to need to have to talk about that. And then Craig sits on the board of the 6 PhD Industrial Holdings Investments, which have a combined turnover circa about £65 million and an EBITDA of around £8 million. That's a serious company or a group of companies. He has a background in advising SME owners on growth strategy, board structure, creating capital value and succession planning and execution. And he has also lectured to leading banks on how to assess the competence of management teams, which is invaluable in his role. Welcome, Craig.
Thank you. Thanks, Dudley.
Yeah, it's a fantastic bio, and our conversation before the episode, wow, this will be really special episodes purely because we have someone that sits on the boards, make sure that the integration happens and sits from an ownership perspective in making sure that the strategy gets fulfilled, but not with a view necessarily on exit, but more with a view in terms of growth. And please tell us, how did you get into the space from 92 being a chartered accountant through to getting into deal making?
Sure. It seems a long time ago now. Excuse me. I suppose in some ways it's been a typical career in terms of I went into a big four accountancy firm, not knowing what accountancy was, went into audit, which most people did in those days, and spent 3 years auditing. And then our department, luckily, was the department in our Preston office that did special work, which is now called corporate finance, M&A, due diligence, corporate recovery, also did tax as well. So it was a really good grounding that I had. And I moved into corporate finance and I thought, actually, I do like this. I'm not saying I understood it at the start, what people were trying to achieve in terms of most of my dealings were with SMEs, and it was selling SMEs to public quoted companies, as well as doing some management buyouts as well. But it's mainly dealing with business owners who'd grown their businesses over the last 20 or 30 years and wanted to sell. So very much gamekeeper turned poacher, because after a number of years, starting probably in 2012, I got involved in acquiring businesses for our investors. So when you're an advisor, it's great in many ways in that you advise the clients the best you can. If there's any issues on the acquisition, you defer to the client and say, look, this is the issue. This is how I think we should deal with it. Excuse me. But at the end of the day, you know, it's your choice whether you want to make this acquisition or increase the price or do whatever you want. Now, when you're buying a business on behalf of investors, of which I'm an investor as well, suddenly you've not really got anybody to ask because advisors are coming to you. So a corporate finance advisor or probably a lawyer is coming to you and saying, look, this is the issue. This is the risk. What do you want to do about it? Now, I work with two other colleagues and we have a chat. We have a think. We've got a chairman as well, who's a very experienced corporate finance advisor in his own right. But whenever you go to him, you know, you get to a certain stage in your career and people want the answers, not a question. So it's a case of, this is the issue, what do you think? And the answer back is, well, what do you think? And that starts happening. That's been happening for quite a few years now. And it's both refreshing, sometimes a bit scary, thinking, crikey, I need to come up with the answer and not just be able to ask someone.
That's interesting because I think comes a time, and I'm like you rightfully mentioned, besides your career that's transitioned from accounting into corporate finance and then into where you are right now, but there comes a time when the mental shift can be assisted by mentors, by coaches, by people that help you along the way. And coaches and mentors, and you probably see this where you are right now in terms of being part of a board and so on, you would be employing new people, you'd be trying to build teams, you'd be doing a whole lot of things like that. But it's sometimes it's better, instead of providing answers, to rather provide better questions or to push back and say, you know, I'm your sounding board, tell me what you think. And that's a much better educable moment, if you like, as opposed to trying to teach all the time or to assist all the time. So tell us a bit about that, because what that transition, how long did it take from you to gain the confidence to start making your own decisions from that initial stage?
It doesn't happen overnight, excuse me. And it's difficult to remember when it actually happened. But one thing I do remember is that when you start off auditing and you're going into a company, so we did big companies, we did small companies, but there was one client I had in particular, only turned over £1 million. And I was going into the business owners and asking them questions about their accounts and their audit. But the problem I had, and the problem a lot of people have, I think, at such a young age of, you know, 22 or whatever, is you don't actually know what you're supposed to know and what you don't know. So I was always worried that the client would be expecting me to know all the answers and I'd be afraid of what I was asking. And then you spin forward 10 years or so, and then you start to realize what you should know and what you shouldn't know. And once you know that, you can confidently say, actually, excuse me, can you repeat that? Or can you just explain that in a different way? Because I don't know what you're talking about. And then they do. And I think for me, that was the aha moment about the confidence I had to ask the right questions and not be worried about whether I should know those answers or not. The other sort of transition from that, still advising, once you're an NED, you have a whole load of hats to wear, as you were saying, Dudley. It's about being a coach. It's about being a mentor. It's about being an advisor. And quite often, the management teams you're dealing with haven't had access to that. They've only had access to the owner of the business. And quite often, as you'll know, owners of businesses and entrepreneurs are often quite dictatorial because that is their style. That's how they've had to grow. They're often self-taught. So a big transition is about how the board table acts. And in fact, most businesses we invest in have never really had a board meeting. So even that's new, the whole concept of a board meeting and reporting both in writing and verbally.
If I think about some SMEs or SMBs or the entrepreneur, let's say it's a founder entrepreneur, because sometimes it's not. Sometimes they may have acquired the business or so on. But if you take founder entrepreneurs and operators, what you have is a nucleus that gets formed around the owner and it becomes chief and many, many helpers.
Yep.
And when you're doing an acquisition, you sometimes have to say, okay, how do I take the chief out? Because the helpers actually won't know what to do. And that's why I'm sort of touching on that now in the beginning of our episode, because I think those are one of the big transition things that you have to deal with. you go in and you do an acquisition, and that comes back down to one of your points there where you talk about, it's about looking at management teams. There we go. So it says also lectured to leading banks on how to assess the competence of management teams, which is invaluable in his role. So the competence of management teams, sometimes there is no management team. Sometimes that you do have, but it's probably only one or two individuals which are probably doing the same thing as what you were doing in the initial part of your career. And I'm going to just circle back and say they're probably going back to the chief with many helpers and saying, what do I do with this? What do I do with that? And there's not enough pushback. And now you come in, you do the acquisition. This is a cultural shift, isn't it? I mean, if you look at that, I mean, tell us a little bit about that shift.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the two, to have a successful business, you've got to have a successful business model and you've got to have a successful or a good management team. And I probably look at about 1,000 companies a year and we probably invest in one or two maybe. Most of them are uninvestable. Some of them, they don't fit our criteria. And then there's a small band that we really like that then we've got to negotiate the price and whatever. The issue we have, though, is that quite often before you buy a business, the only access you have is to the owner who's probably going to leave and he won't give you access to the management team, quite rightly, because they think, well, if you don't complete this acquisition, I've got to tell them why. So that is the trickiest thing in making an acquisition, assessing the management team you're going to inherit, or indeed, if there isn't a management team, as you alluded to, Dudley, what is the gap? What's the void going to be and how we're going to fill it when the owner leaves? And what's the culture like? So that is the biggest risk to us. We can assess the business model because we can do financial due diligence, legal due diligence, we can do some market due diligence, and we only invest in businesses that we understand, that we can touch and feel, as opposed to technology or widgets that go into some other process that we can't assess. So we like to keep things simple, but going back to the culture, it's just so difficult. Ideally, we'd like access to the senior management team. And in fact, nowadays, it's rare that we do an acquisition without having access to the senior management team because it's just too risky. We've done it in the past. We've bought 100% of businesses without meeting the management team because we weren't allowed. And then we've recruited management teams. And that's harder. It's always better if you've got a management team already there. But even with the management team already there, they're very much coached by the owner and by the owner's advisor as well about what the management team can say and can't say. Because, of course, they're still employed by the owner and they're not sure whether the acquisition's going to go ahead or not. That's very tricky for us. Culture is very difficult. And quite often, there's got to be a bit of a leap of faith when you buy when you buy a company. And part of that leap of faith should get smaller and smaller as time goes on, as you get more experience, because you get to know where the pitfalls probably are. So one thing we do to mitigate the effect of the owner leaving is making sure that we only acquire businesses where the biggest customer is no more than 5%, 6%, 7% of the turnover, such that if that customer disappeared, it would be a bit of a nightmare, but it wouldn't really affect the business catastrophically. So the biggest lesson I had in that was many years ago when I was advising a company and they were providing services to a larger company, and there were 6 businesses in the UK that provided these services. And I was acting for the seller, one of these 6 business partners, as they called them. But most of their turnover was to this particular customer, about 50% actually. And I said to the owner, what happens if that customer decides to use somebody else? And they said, well, that won't happen. I said, why is that? Because we've got such a really good relationship with the buyer. We go on holiday with them. We're family friends. Now, you can guess what happened. Next time the contract was up for renewal, and they were the best performing business partner in the UK as well. However, what the client didn't know, what nobody knew, was that the larger company, they needed to rationalize their supplier base from 6 to 3. And unfortunately, whilst this one was the best performing one and they were personal friends, there was another supplier that did 2 other key areas, and it made sense economically for them to do this one. So that taught me never to invest in, and we didn't. I was an advisor on that, so it didn't affect me. It affected the client. But what it taught me was never to invest in a business that's wholly reliant on 1 or 2 customers. And the reason why I'm mentioning that is because we're interviewing, doing due diligence with the business owner, and the business owner is obviously telling us everything that's great about the business and all the relationships. They always say, I don't do much in the business now. When you ask them the question, what do you do? Oh, I don't do much. I have loads of holidays. I hardly come in. X, Y, and Z deal with everyone. And that is hard to judge. The other interesting example we had, we acquired a business once and it didn't go particularly well. And the reason for that is the guy who owned it, his role was quite a sundry role. It was operations, and it was quite a simple role in a way. And the key role was selling that his business partner had, who was a minority shareholder, and he wanted to buy the other guy out. So we thought, well, actually, if the ops guy goes, it doesn't matter because it's just logistics. Somebody else can do that, which was true. Somebody else could do that. But what we hadn't realized was the majority shareholder, he instilled the culture on all the employees. And we just failed to realize that all the sales guys, they weren't driven by the sales guy who we were backing. They were driven by the culture that the majority owner instilled. So that was another learning as well. And finally, even post-acquisition, we've got to be careful to make sure that we don't only see the directors and the management team, because you only know what you know and you don't know what you don't know. And COVID was a bit of an issue sometimes because we just had Teams meetings with the two or three or four senior members of the management team, and we couldn't actually go and speak to people when you're wandering around. I'm not suggesting we do a factory tour every time we go to a company every month, but you just see people and you just notice things.
If you look at sales and marketing as a, let's call it a work stream, or as a particular operational or part of the business, often when you have a relationship with, if let's say I've got a customer and they are one of the big, I'm an SME, I've got a big customer, they a large chain or they're a listed entity, but I in fact only know one person in that 20,000 employee company, and they buying from me because they like me and they're my mates and I've been working with them for 20 years. But the other 19,999 employees don't know who I am. Mm. Now you've got an SME servicing this client, and often it's hidden in the fact that they're actually not. They might have a contract, but they actually got a relationship with one person. Mm. What they fail to do, often SMEs fail to penetrate larger organizations and establish proper contracts, firstly. Secondly, establish proper relationship within the larger entities that they serve. Mm. Then thirdly, like you mentioned, I mean, that's a really, really good point. Often they get stuck at one or two big customers. Mm. Why? Because they can't take on any more work. And that becomes their ceiling is, I mean, they get very happy about the win. Like, yeah, I got that big customer. Oh, shoot, I got that big customer because now I can't do anything else. So now this conundrum, you know, enters the business. They get to a certain point, like decent turnover, decent EBITDA, the whole lot. But in fact, it's a lot of smoke and mirrors. It's not really that plain cut or plain and simple. So, yeah, just tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, because when I said that most companies aren't saleable, a large number of those are because they're reliant on a customer. And depending on the margin of a customer or a business, it might be once a business has a customer that's more than, say, 20% of its turnover, if you take the margin away from that customer, suddenly you're loss-making. And that means it's really difficult to acquire, unless you have some kind of earn-out based on that particular customer carrying on for the next few years. We tried to do one of those, and it didn't complete in the end. They're always complex. The other issue with that is it's a great business to own. You've got that customer, you're making lots of money, and it's great, but not for somebody else to buy. So there's a lot of businesses, I call them income-generating models, where the great businesses to own, but they're too risky for somebody else to buy.
It's lifestyle. I mean, it's a lifestyle business, isn't it, to a great extent?
No, absolutely. Now, I come back to management. The way we mitigate about the risks of new management versus old management, the effect of the owner going in relationships, is we try to make sure we only acquire or invest in businesses where the business has various ways of phrasing this that I use, has a real purpose and it adds value to the supply chain. And quite often, if you look at our portfolio of businesses, you think, well, that's a really eclectic mix of businesses. However, most of them do a small part of somebody else's larger supply chain. And therefore, For example, we've got a chemical manufacturer, and the chemical in a finished product might cost a customer £20, but the chemical that we sell to the intermittent customer might cost 10 pence. So the rest of it is tax, packaging, freight, the profit of the brand owner, da 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 da. So there's no point in the brand owner trying to come to our customer and say, can we have it for 9 pence, please? Because of all the regulation and the cost of changing. So it's quite a sticky revenue. We've got another business that's a branded manufacturer of a branded product, and it's specified in somebody's supply chain. So it's all about, when you're acquiring and integrating, it's all about making sure the value is in the business and not in the people. Now, I come from an advisory background, which is a people business. There's lots of people businesses out there. There's consultancies, there's lawyers, there are accountants. They are very difficult businesses to sell or acquire because a lot of the value is in those people, whether they're the work winners or the doers. And that's why we don't acquire people businesses, because they're just too difficult to acquire, because your intellectual property is outside the business and the people. We try to make sure we buy what we call real businesses. We call them boring businesses. They're not high growth businesses, and therefore we're getting them at good prices to reflect that. And we're investing in businesses where we think we can add value, where we've got some kind of comparative advantage. So if somebody shows us a business that's a really high performing business that's high growth, it's unlikely to be one for us, because we feel, you know, we can't add value and it'd be too expensive. And there's other acquirers and investors that would buy those. But we like to buy businesses that've got lots of customers. The average order value is fairly low. There's a high repeat customer base. And, you know, I use the term like a sausage machine. It'll take a long time to go wrong. And in that time, we can transition from founder or original owner to new management that we may go out and headhunt. So it's all just like everything in business. It's about the risk and reward ratio. And if you can get your risk really low, your potential rewards can come down as well. You know, we're competing in a very small part of the private company arena. So the EBITDAs of the businesses we're looking at are typically $500,000 to $2 million. Above that, you've got other private equity investors and trade buyers who are interested. But anything below $2 million or $1 million, they're hard businesses to sell, because they're not going to change the dial for a corporate investor. You know, in the past, I've been trying to sell businesses with an EBITDA of £1 million to companies that turn over, you know, 500 million, £1 billion. They're not interested. It doesn't turn the dial, unless it does something magical that they can really scale up.
Yeah. And what, I mean, you're already sharing a whole lot of golden nuggets. You're building a winning formula, which I'm guessing maybe you want to share your journey in this winning formula. So the winning formula is, it comes from the initial experience of having that one entity that had a too big a customer. I mean, that's sort of golden nugget one. The high risk sits in having customer concentration levels too high. The other golden nugget that I'm getting, and this is what I'm hearing you say, is that lower value, higher volume transactions tend to give you a bit of a delayed effect in terms of writing, you know, the mistakes or the market changes or whatever it is. You got time to adjust. It's not too rapid. So, I mean, that's another really good point that you made there. The other thing that's really interesting, that the point you're making there, is that in terms of your, I mean, you call it eclectic, but it fits within a model. I mean, if you look at the six entities that you've got, and maybe you want to just share a little bit about what they are. I don't have to give the names, but I mean, you can just share how they're made up, because I think together they make a significantly good business. On their own, they don't necessarily do that. And this is what we talk about, sort of the value creation or the synergy capture, all those big, you know, consulting terms that we talk about. Tell us a bit about that mix. And it's a steady, eddy, slow process, isn't it? It's buying one, getting it right, buying another, getting it right, and so on. I mean, you're not necessarily, although you're looking at 1,000 businesses a year, you're not flying out the gates and saying, we're going to buy everything that we see. So tell us a little bit about that sort of philosophy, if you can.
Yeah, sure. The first fund we raised in 2008 was, in fact, it was, we raised it in the same month that I think RBS and Northern Rock went bust. So it wasn't a great time to set up a fund. We raised some money from our clients. We'd already got two transactions lined up. And then over the next 3 or 4 years, we invested in four others. Now, they were really eclectic and there was no fit whatsoever between them. We did well, though. We had, you know, two or three real winners, one or two, and we made a really good return. So on the back of that, we raised a larger fund that's now created these six businesses that we've now incorporated. So previously, it was a typical 10-year life private equity fund. And our second fund was as well. But what we realized in the second fund is we realized what looked good and what we were good at, which was these industrial type B2B businesses. But the issue is they take longer to get from founder ownership into non-family ownership and then to create a growth strategy. If you're in a 10-year fund, you've got to invest, grow and exit within the 10 years for all the companies in that fund. And my view is life doesn't work in 10-year circles. Life, with SMEs and companies, they might be quick in and out, but typically they're much longer. So we incorporated the fund early last year into a limited company called PhD Industrial Holdings. And we've got about 100 high net worth shareholders. And we said to our investors, this is what we want to do, because rather than setting up a fund, buying a business and then selling it and giving you the money back when you don't want it and that you get taxed, and then asking you for it back to do another fund, why don't you just keep it in the company? Because with a holding company, if you've got a majority share of a business, when you sell that company, there's no tax to pay. So our investors can leave their returns compounding tax-free over the years. And I know I'm going left of center talking about tax now, but it is one of the reasons why we set the fund up. So it gives us more time that matches the growth of these businesses. But also the business is inheritance tax free as well, because it's a share in a private company. So our investors are happy to leave their value compounding. And I mentioned something about business to business. That's something I've not mentioned earlier. We've had better experience of business to business businesses than business to consumers. And what our experience has told us that with business to business, it takes longer to get a customer. It's all about demonstrating to the customer why they should buy your product or service, what the attributes are, the aftercare, the relationship. Do you trust this buyer? And it might take months or years to build that relationship. And then finally, the customer, the potential customer, wants to talk about price, but they only want to talk about price if they're happy with everything else. And it takes a long time to win a customer, and it should take a long time to lose them. For those very reasons, they've chosen to use you for a reason. So that's why we like business to business. Now, I know a lot of people won't agree with me, but this is my experience. With business to consumer, the reason why a consumer will buy a product from you is down to two reasons. It's typically, unless it's a brand, so that you've got some cult brands out of there. So I'm on my Apple MacBook, I've got my iPad here, I've got my Apple earphones, and I've got my iPhone, because I'm sold on the iPhone cult brand. Leave that aside, most consumer businesses, it's all about the price and the weather. Now, the price, everyone understands, because of the internet, you can get it cheaper. You don't need to touch and feel it these days. You know it's going to arrive. With clothing, it's slightly different, but you can send them back, so that's fine. And whenever I say about the weather, people say, well, that's not right. And then they sit back and think, you know what? There is something in that. Because the weather affects whether you're booking a holiday, whether you're buying a jumper or an umbrella. You think about it. It's those two things. And whilst you're a consumer, I'm a consumer, without insulting either of us, we're very fickle. And there's not a lot of loyalty, apart from brand loyalty. That aside, there's not a lot of loyalty. It's about, well, can I get the product? How much is it? Can I get it here on time, next day, or whenever it is? And business to business is completely different. So when I see businesses like they sell mattresses in a box, I think, well, the cost of the acquiring that customer is massive on Google AdWords. Now, once you've bought a new mattress, when are you going to buy another mattress? And I know that people have got more than one bed in the house, but it's only after a few years. And I know the mattress company say, oh, you've got to get a new one every 2 years, of course. But you don't buy that many, do you? We're seeing a lot of companies at the moment, and I call it the COVID bounce. They've had a COVID, you know, bounce in sales. And a good example is sofa businesses. We didn't buy a sofa ourselves, but most people are sat there thinking, I can't go on holiday. I can't go anywhere. I'm going to buy myself a sofa. Once you bought a sofa, you're not going to buy one for the next 5 years. And that's, there's a lot of businesses who've made a lot of sales. And you still can't, you know, you still can't see where they're at in the cycle. Hot tubs are another one. You know, people are wondering why consumer spending is going down. It's because people cannot fit any more stuff in their house at the moment.
Well, I mean, if you just think of how quickly your house fills up when you start going on a bit of a buying spree.
Yeah, yeah.
That's very interesting. The weather does impact. And there's also only that much money to go around because it's also wallet share. I mean, we're also looking at external geographic, geopolitical issues as well, supply chain, cost of living. I mean, they're calling it a crisis, but I mean, this is bound to happen, and it's just eventually happened. I mean, I didn't think it happened pre-pandemic anyway. I think it was just needed just a bit of a trigger. But
yeah,
there's so many things. But what's really evident for me is, Craig, is your experience in the SME space, is your thorough understanding of the dynamics that sit within that environment. That's that, I think you said, 1 to 2 million space that's not necessarily interesting for a private equity or a, let's call it a strategic corporate buyer and so on. It's a fascinating space. But if you think about the size of the market, that's why you're looking at 1,000 deals. I think there are about 5 million odd businesses in the UK.
Yeah.
To look at 1,000 deals is a drop in the bucket compared to the number of registered businesses, because really 70, 80% of them are sitting at that level in any case. So you're looking at quite a few million in that space. Mm. And I mean, you're looking at 1,000. It sounds like a lot, but as you go lower down to the market, it literally just sort of explodes. Anything below, I think, 2 million or 1.5, I think it gets even, I think below a 500,000, I think it gets even worse.
Yeah.
But yeah. So I think what's evident for me is your thorough understanding of that space, and then also the B2B space as opposed to B2C. Just, I don't know if you want to just expand on what I've just said.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was listening to a podcast a couple of years ago, and I can't remember his name now. He was saying the way to make money, or the way to really excel at something, is to be really narrowly defined on your expertise in a particular item. And his go-to product was a particular Rolex watch. And it was also a Ferrari, but a Ferrari between the dates of 1967 to 1972. And he was saying, look, I know nothing about Ferraris other than those dates. And I know nothing about Rolex watches apart from a Rolex Daytona or something between the ages of 1984 to 1989 or something like that. And what he was trying to demonstrate was, you know, you need to instill and instill and go deeper and deeper into something, you know. And I was listening to it thinking, what do I know? What am I interested in? What comparative advantage have I got? And then I thought, you know what? It is actually my day job. That is what I know a lot about. Because as you said, you've got millions and millions of companies out there and businesses out there. And inadvertently, we've distilled it down to a set of broad criteria that we stick to. So those 1,000 companies every year, it's quite easy to go, no, no, no. Ah, yes, please, can I have an NDA for that? And the IM, we'll have a look at that. Is it what we think? Mm. Yeah, it looks great. Oh, there's a customer, it's 20% of the turnover. We can't do that. Or actually, no, it actually looks pretty good. Let's do a meeting. And these days, of course, the first meetings are on Teams still. Mm. Now, I prefer to do things face-to-face. Before COVID, I'd never the odd time I'd use Zoom, Teams. But now everyone prefers it because it cuts down on time. It means you can do more in less time. And also with business owners who are selling the business, they don't want you to go to their business. It's all confidential. A Teams meeting, it is great. But it is your proverbial, you know, hopper of all those, you know, where do you start by trying to invest in a business? You've got the whole of the UK. And in fact, you've got the whole of the world. And we just acquire in the UK because language, distance, and all that kind of stuff. And even though we can do things online, we wouldn't invest in Europe. We'd buy a European business as a subsidiary of an existing one, but not as a standalone investment. So you come down to all these a smaller subset. And the way we get to that subset is, well, which companies are actually for sale? Because another strategy you could have is, well, let's do some research. And the internet's, you know, fantastic. Let's do some research about companies that are out there that do things that we want to invest in. But the problem there is most of them will not be for sale. And I'm making numbers up. It might be 49 out of every 50 are not for sale in that sector. So what's the point approaching 50 or thousands just to find one or two? So it's easier to our approach is actually to wait for people to approach us with companies for sale, because at least we know the owner wants to sell. And that is half the problem, really. We've tried approaching companies before, and it's great because, you know, you have a conversation with them and say, well, actually, timing's not right at the moment. And then, you know, 5 years later, they'll have kept you left your email, they'll ring you up, and that's fine. You can also reduce the odds, of course, by searching for directors who are of a particular age. But it's more laborious, that, because is the son in the business? Is he going to sell to his, hand it down and all that kind of stuff? So we just keep things simple. And, you know, we've put a lot of time and effort into making connections with people who sell companies, such that every day I get, you know, a handful of emails with companies for sale. And that's how you get 1,000 a year. So it sounds a lot, but it actually over a year, it's not that many. And, say 1,000, if you distill it down to the number a day, actually, it's probably 2,000. But it's quick to get rid of the ones that don't fit our criteria.
I think the critical thing there for me is with that amount of experience, knowledge, and understanding, already having a base of acquired entities, having gone through potentially a few learning steps as well, learning a few potholes that you've probably stripped into, but you get smarter. I think that's what you were saying. You get better at the selection. If we sort of switch into sort of integration mode and we say, if I'm selecting my acquired business, if I'm selecting it based on a set of criteria, knowing what the outcome is going to be, knowing what my recipe, and I'm just putting that out there, I don't know if you do have a recipe, but knowing what the process will be once I've acquired them, knowing what my process is to get the acquisition, but once I've signed the deal, what I need to do to make sure I secure that asset, because it doesn't help I've gone through 1,000 or 2,000 no's, whittled it down to 2 or 3, 4 entities that look interesting, having those endless conversations. I mean, I've had conversations in Costa coffee shops and, you know, up in the weirdest of places, and these kids flying around, and, you know, and you just can't even have a proper conversation yet. You can't go and see the actual business, and you have no idea what you're really buying. So a lot of it's on faith, and a lot of it is on gut feel and instinct. But you get that out of really hard-earned experience, but also just knowing your market, knowing your niche.
Yeah.
And I think that, I mean, they say, what's it, the Americans say, the riches on the niches. You know, I don't know if that means anything to you, but it's basically niching it down, knowing what you're good at, knowing what you're not good at. And I think that's probably even more important than knowing what you're good at. But then also to have a plan, I would imagine, to go forward. And having had this conversation with you prior to the podcast as well, just expand a bit on that. So now you've made a selection. What happens next?
Yeah, so we found something we want to acquire. We've agreed the price. We do an amazing amount of due diligence, financial, legal, operational, property, you name it. So whilst we may have only had a look around the business once physically, we've spent a lot of time with the owner. We've hopefully spent time with the management team as well. But the due diligence will really goes into so much depth to throw up potential issues, but actually potential opportunities as well. We do know, whilst I talked about a leap of faith, there's always going to be that leap of faith. But these days, it's you know, gut feel, you know, it's a small amount. Most of it is probably more scientific. Then you acquire it. And the improvements we think we can make, as I say, we make sure that the profit and the cash generation of the business we are acquiring will not go backwards. That's our first thing. And we think by doing some relatively simple things, we can maintain that and grow it and get it a better quality income as well. So to start a business up and get to a turnover of 5 million is very difficult to do. And that's where your entrepreneurs come in and build it to 5 million. Or I know we read about people who get it up to hundreds of millions, but let's talk about our market space. And it might take 20 years. And that's another thing. We'll only invest in a business that's been going for a long time. So the average life of our six businesses is probably 20 to 30 years. It's maybe more, actually. They're proven. They've not just started up and proven over a number of years. The relatively easy win, the two wins we normally get, one is we'll probably bring some better financial metrics to it. The people in the business have got a better appreciation of what affects margin and pricing and ultimately the bottom line. So there's a bit of that we can bring to it. And also the confidence to say, well, hang on a second. I know that's your major customer, but their margin is a lot lower than the others. So why don't we go back and increase prices, which is always a tough one. But we give the management teams, we empower them and give them the confidence to do that. There are risks. The customer could say, well, I'm walking away. But the businesses, going back full circle, the businesses we're investing in have pricing power. There's a reason for being, and the income's pretty sticky. So we're quite confident that, again, based on experience, that the customers will take those price increases. So that's one side of it. And the second side of it, and it also you can lump into their better systems, and you know, you talk about ERP, better reporting systems, and IT systems as well. The other part of it is just unleashing the business from the business owner, because the business owner, as I said, typically he's taking it from 0 to 5 million. He's set it up in his 30s. He's into his late 50s, 60s, or what? And apologies for being ageist. But at that time of life, I'm that kind of age as well, but I've not got that attitude at the moment. People want to take it easier, and therefore they're not willing to take the business risks that got them from 0 to 5. So we think, well, if that person semi-retires or steps back and the next tier of management team come through, or indeed we bring somebody else in to supplement the management team, they're incentivized to grow it from 5 million to 10 or 15 or 20. And that's what we do. We heavily incentivize our management teams with equity. So we pay them fairly and well as well. But really, they can make some really tax-efficient money by growing the value of the business from the point we invest to peer. It's in the margin, but it's also getting the right people involved as well. They've got the right experience from outside the company rather than the self-grown business owner.
Yeah, when you're going into a business, you're looking for somebody that has potentially got no sales and marketing, really. He relies, yeah. He or she, I don't want to be gender specific, but you have this situation where the owner has got comfortable in terms of, you know, just living off their reputation potentially, or just because they're there, they've got a bunch of mates they've been doing business with for a while. So they work off what they call word of mouth. That I love when I hear that. Because then I absolutely know there's huge leverage there to be had. And often I've also seen, and I want to add this in and then just get your view on it. I've seen the longer that the owner has been in the business, the older they are, the less they've increased their prices over the years. So they've progressively, their prices have actually gone down. If you look at market conditions, new companies are charging much higher margins, giving exactly the same or maybe slightly different service, having much better sales and marketing. Gains are massive if you get them select the right entity. Tell me about that.
Yeah, it is all about pricing power and the ability to push those prices onto customers. And you know, quite often we'll give that empowerment to the management teams, and it will lead to losing some customers at the lower end, but they're actually not contributing. So we may as well get a better margin from 90% of the customers than lower margin from them and lose that 10% or whatever. And you're right, Dully. The third aspect that I forgot about what makes a business attractive is that they've grown up on the back of their current customer base and being successful in the past, and they've not invested in sales and marketing because they haven't had to. They don't need to. They're making 800,000, 600,000 clear profit a year in dividends between 1, 2, 4 people. Why try and employ somebody on a fancy salary who's unproven? Because the feedback you'll get from business owners is, salespeople always overpromise and underdeliver. You know, that's probably true. They sell themselves very well in interviews. Whereas we've got a different outlook in that we're acquiring a business here. We want to grow it to here. How do we do that? Well, we need to invest in people. Most of the businesses we invest in, they're very capex light. We don't like businesses that might make £1 million profit, but they spend 300 every year in new capex, and they've got to keep doing that. We need to make sure that they're generating proper cash. But our investment normally comes in terms of people. So if a business is selling a product and it sold it for forever, which other customers could it sell to? Which other territories could it sell into? Which other complementary? It's typical Ansoft Matrix stuff. It's textbook stuff. We try and instill in a business and say, okay, how can we get into that territory? How can we get into those customers? Well, let's employ somebody to do it. Let's use a headhunter to find somebody from the sector. Let's just have a look, because a lot of business owners are very inwardly focused in that, you know, that's what they're doing. That's worked well. But actually, if we can just bring some, you know, helicopter view on other things we've seen, that's another point you picked up on before, Dudley, about, you know, we've got six businesses and the more focus there is between them, the more they can cross share ideas and expertises, because our businesses, they turn over between 3 million and 20 million turnover. You know, they're not massive companies, but they're quite sizable private companies. And they've all got high performing management teams. And it's a shame that each one has got a high performing management team. So what if you get them all in the same room, proverbial room, or get them cross-fertilizing ideas in terms of how they buy or how they sell and the routes to market? And suddenly you get the sum of the parts, the whole is bigger than the sum of the parts.
From a management team's perspective, there's a sense, and I'm not sure if it's real or not, but there, for me, there's always a sense that if I'm part of a bigger group, there's a bit of a safety net. There's a sounding board. There's someone I can bounce things off. Because if you think about an SME on their own, it's a very lonely world. Mm. If you've got a management team that's part of a bigger group and you have NEDs like yourself with massive experience and all the knowledge and understanding, you could get people working together and you know, people working together just bring a much better result at the end of the day. So I'm loving your formula.
Yeah, it is massive, actually. That's another good point you make, because we're getting these high-performing people out of other businesses. Most of the businesses we invest in don't have a finance director because the owners don't value what a finance director does. So we say, let's bring a finance director in. Inevitably, they will either be from a big four or they'll be from a bigger organization that they're part of. And we're asking them to go into a smaller SME as the number one finance person. So it does help them knowing there's five other people who they can just call on, and our group FD as well. And it's the same thing with the managing directors as well. I think they like the fact that as well as us, the three or four of us as NEDs across the group, they've also got access to the five other people. Now, not all of them will be as relevant as others, but they'll strike up some really good relationships and, you know, hopefully friendships with two or three of those other managing directors. Because we all know, of course, that being the managing director or the owner of a business is the most lonely place, because there's never quite anyone on your par. Now, we try and create parts. We use the word partnership, but we work in partnership a lot with the management teams. But we see it, the core of a management team as a partnership themselves. And it's typically managing director and finance director. Now, there might also be a sales director. There might be an operations director. Mm-hmm. There might be some other type of director. But all our companies will have a managing director and a finance director, and that's often the core team. And that's because of the managing director is typically sales and marketing and operations and everything, and he's got a lot of direct reports. And why do we hold finance director in so high regard? Because of that first leg of our strategy, maximizing your margin and pricing.
If you've ever done scuba diving and that, that's the buddy system. You know, go down underwater with a buddy. Don't do it alone.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
You know, work with somebody and make sure there's someone, you know, on the surface that can pull you up if you're in trouble or whatever it is. So, and I think it's almost that kind of analogy, isn't it? Mm. It's a buddy system. Go in and do your whatever you're going to do under the water. Mm. You know, you've got a backup system, the NEDs on the surface, but you also have your accountability or your buddy that's working with you on the journey, which is a totally different dynamic. And I'm sure the employees of the companies, of the target companies, feel better, they feel more confident, they probably feel there's a growth path for them career-wise. I'm just making assumptions, but if all of a sudden they're part of a bigger group, they want to go to work. The owner's today having a bad day, he's now moaning at everyone because nobody's done any work. Oh, just hopefully Monday's not going to be the same. Mm. That kind of dynamic is almost taken out completely. And now you've created this bigger organism. Let's call it an improved organism in a way. I mean, would you agree with that?
Yeah, people don't like change, do they? So when they read, when they get a press release internally, memo that says we've now been sold and taken over. Obviously, that's a really worrying time. Nobody likes change. What we say to people is, what we say to business owners and the employees is that we, it's a bit like one of those, is it Philip Patak watches? The advert says you never actually own one. You just look after it for the next generation. And that's what we say about businesses. We might not own it forever, but hopefully under our stewardship, we will improve it. Now, if a business is sold to a strategic, I call them trade buyers, that's a big risk for employees because they could just strip the heart and soul out of the business. They could consolidate, you know, warehousing and sales and marketing, all sorts of things. With us, we invest in a business where there's a proven business model and we don't fix something that's not broken. We may acquire and bolt things on. We may encourage the management teams to grow organically, and that's great, great for everyone. But the business will stay autonomous, albeit it will be under PhD IH's ownership. So I think all stakeholders like it in terms of the vendors like it because it's a good story to their employees in the outside world. The management teams like it when they're talking to customers and suppliers, and employees like it because there's transparency. Whereas previously, under a private equity ownership, everyone knows it's only 10 years and you've got to sell it. And therefore, it's just like a holding period, whereas we can keep our businesses forever if we want. And just a bit like Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway, you know, in some respects, it takes so long to find a good business and so long to create that growth strategy with the management team. Why then be pressured to sell it 2 years later just because you're in a 10-year private equity fund? Most of the UK businesses are either owned by business owners themselves. They're either publicly listed, which obviously isn't that many, but if they're owned by the public sector. And then you've got ones that are owned by private equity. And then you've got some investment vehicles as well, like ours. But there's not that many. I could only name three others that I've really come across. Interestingly, there's more cropping up, which are quoted on the Scandinavian stock markets. They're realizing it's a good way of creating shareholder value by putting similar synergistic businesses together, albeit keeping them autonomous, so they can be sold if they want to. So we do sell our businesses, but we'll only sell one of our businesses if somebody approaches us and says, we need your business for strategic reasons, therefore we're going to pay you a small fortune. We'll do that. Or if one of the stakeholders says, actually, we'd like to sell now, which might be the management team, or a founder shareholder who's still got an investment, we'll go in with an agreed strategy. We might hold something for 3 years, 5 years, or it might be 20 years. But it's all about having that transparency, the relationship, the communication. And also what people want to do changes over the years, whether it's family, ill health, or just want to do something else. So it's got to be, it's quite formulaic, but it's also got to have an element of flexibility in it as well for the whole structure to work.
I love it. It's just, I could speak to you for hours. I want to quickly switch gears and go to inaugural Northwest Insider Awards. You were voted Corporate Finance Advisor of the Year and Dealmaker of the Year in Lancashire. Tell me a bit about that, because the reason why I'm asking is what's evident to me, if I think what is the real value in what you're creating is really the team of the three or four of you, NEDs. You are the real management team. You're creating something of serious value. And I think that is the special, the magic dust or fairy dust or whatever they want to call it, that you've managed to create a formula that works. You've managed to create the filter to filter out all the things that aren't going to suit you as a group. It might work for someone else, but for you as a group, you found your method of working together. And this, I think that's probably for me where it's all coming. So I want to go to those awards, if you can quickly share that. And then just come back to where I think the real value in what you have created as a group is probably sitting at the NED level, although you do have strong teams in that and you've applied a lot of the principles. Sure. But in order to really grow, I mean, if I look at 65 million, you probably be 165 in a few years, and then 300, then 500. And next thing you see, you're in a different ball game. You're going to have to bring in more people to support you, and you have to systemize a lot of the things that you're doing yourself. So, okay, let's go back to the award. And then I want you to maybe just talk a bit about your company. I want you to sort of punch your company a bit and say, look, what kind of investor or people are you looking for?
Sure.
I don't know if it's investors, but I think you're looking more for companies to buy. Mm-hmm. But let's start at the awards and then end up at the nice. Tell us what you want, what you're looking
at. Yeah, I don't always put that on my bio because these days it doesn't really mean much. But back then, going back 20 years, it was one of the, you know, the first awards. It was only Lancashire, which is part of the Northwest, which is part of the UK. So it's only Lancashire. But it was quite pleasing to get both of the Corporate Finance and Dealmaker Awards the first time they've been run in Lancashire. And Lancashire is full of great professionals. So these days, you know, there's on LinkedIn, there's award after award after award. So it doesn't sound that great now. But back then, it was something. So I'm proud of that. And in terms of the team and what we're creating, you know, we're having a debate at the moment. What are we actually, you know, what are we doing? Are we just growing a collection of assets that's worth as much as we can get it for the benefit of our shareholders? Mm-hmm. Okay, that's fine. But are we trying to create a legacy formula that can be passed down to other people to carry on growing it? If we get this to 100 million, 200, 500, who knows how you get paid, interest. It comes to a point where it's creating a legacy. So it'd be nice to create a legacy that, you know, in 20 years, 30 years, it's still going and we created that and we were part of that. The reason why I think we're successful, we've made mistakes in the past and we've learned from those and hopefully the mistakes will get less. I often used to say to people, I've never really had a proper job because I was just an advisor and then doing some investing in NED work. And now I guess I am a full-time executive director of a company. So it is a real job actually, albeit in a way it's not, because the real hard work is what the management teams are doing with their individual businesses, dealing with their customers and suppliers. But I guess it is a real job because we're dealing with investors. We're dealing with, I mean, our stakeholders are different. The people we're buying businesses off, they become shareholders possibly. So it's not your typical stakeholder analysis. But what we're looking for, we're looking to increase our investor base. As I said, we've got about 100 high net worth investors. So we're always looking to increase our investor base because it's fine investing in a private company that's growing, but how do you actually get out of it? So we have dealing days every 6 months where we as directors say, look, we think the net asset value is this. Do any of our shareholders want to sell any of their shares or all of their shares? And also, do we know any investors, either existing ones or new ones, who want to buy into the journey as well? Because ultimately, we want to increase the value of the company and increase the shareholder base as well. And of course, as you alluded to, Dudley, the other thing is to be introduced to more companies who want to be part of our journey as well, where the shareholders don't necessarily want to sell out fully, because you can actually sell to somebody. It might not be for the right price, but you can always sell. Whereas we say, well, you know, what should be important to somebody who's looking to sell should be time, i.e. time out of the business, because you've been working 24/7 for 30 years. But that doesn't mean you want to get out of the business completely. You might want to just drop down your days. You might want to just become non-executive chairman, and you still might want to be investor in the business. Because of course, if you sell your business these days, what do you do with your cash? Where do you put it? What do you do with it? Why not leave some invested in a business that you know full well is a good business and should go on to greater things?
I love it. What I would potentially like to see more of are owner founders and people that are looking at exit to stop looking at the business that they've built as an extension of themselves, which they often do. They get very sentimentally attached to it, but rather think of it as, again, the custodian. I think you spoke about that, you know, this is not, I'm not going to be here forever. I'm the one that's running out of time. It's the business can carry on for as however long it's relevant in the market. But if the thing that I would like to see, and something that guys like you can actually do, is to say, how do we get owner entrepreneurs or owner founders to have multiple exits? How about join a company like yours, go on a 3 or 5 or 10 year journey, and grow it to another size? You've still got an equity stake, but you've brought in the right kind of people to take you, then take some more money off the table and do another exit, and then do another exit. You know, it's not the end and it's not a retirement day. In fact, I think a lot of owner founders or owner entrepreneurs should say, you know, after 10, 15, maybe even 5 years, I should start saying, all right, what can I do to start doing a rotation in terms of ownership, because I can only take it to a certain level unless my goal is lifestyle. I want the boat, I want the house, I want the beach home, whatever it is that makes them happy. But once you've got that stuff, it's like there's not much more than that. I mean, you can only have that many pina coladas on some beach somewhere, and then what? So why don't you think about the passion, your purpose sits within the business that you've so lovingly grown over 20 or 30 years. Stay in it. Yeah. But stay in it at a lower value, but realize that you've got limitations. Bring teams like yourself in. Say, okay, come in. Let's grow this thing bigger. I want to have another exit, but now I want to sit in a different role. I want to enjoy my life again. I want to refine a new career or new journey for myself. And I think there should be gaps, and people should start doing that earlier. I think people should start doing it in their late 30s and 40s already. I mean, by the time you're in your 40s, you probably had that business 15 years. Mm-hmm. And I've got this saying, you may or may not have heard it, but where often you have someone that's had a business for 30 years, they've had the business for a year repeated 30 times, because they probably haven't actually done anything to it from the time they started. They did a few things. They've got a few customers. It's been very, very hard to get it to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 million, whatever it is. But they've done pretty much the same thing. They've just repeated it. And then they stopped because they can't, they have no further skill or assistance, or they just can't see that there's bigger scope. I'm just sort of trying to prompt you to finish off the conversation on a sort of a high note here.
It's a good point. We encourage business owners to have a minority stake, one, to keep them interested, and two, to help them get further value in the future. And secondly, what we've not done at the moment, but selling shareholders can do, they can also buy a stake in the holding company if they believed in the whole journey. That's not happened yet, but it will do, where people actually swap their minority stakes for a stake in the holding company. Or internal investors who've got a business that doesn't fit with our criteria, there's nothing stopping them saying, you know what, I've got my business here and I'm keeping my business, or I'm selling it to somebody else. But actually, I like the journey you're going on, because I think I can add value to some of your group companies, because I understand that industry, I can open some doors, and they become like more interactive shareholders, as opposed to anybody can buy shares in a quoted investment trust or a public company. But it's very difficult to buy shares in a private investment trust like we've got, the shareholder base ultimately.
I think you're on a winning path, and I'm not sure how it's going to change. But as I said, just before we went live, I'd like to come on online again as you build out on what you're doing. I think it's an amazing journey you're on. I think you've narrowed it down absolutely brilliant. Thank you for joining us today, Craig.
No, thank you. I've really enjoyed it. It's amazing how much you actually get out of it by sharing your story. And it makes you think, because you start thinking about things a different way. So thank you. I've enjoyed it.
So stay on the line. I was going to say goodbye to the audience. And let me just change the screen. There we go. And thank you, everyone, for joining us today on our 100 Days and Beyond podcast, where we had an amazing Craig Richardson from Dow Schofield Watts. I think absolutely brilliant. PhD. I'm going to put the link in the chat, in the bio. Please get hold of him. There are multiple things that you can be doing. Have a conversation. I think it's well worth it. And the wealth of experience is absolutely brilliant. I think it's different guest to what you may be used to. This is in the SME space. So thank you for joining us today. And we're looking forward to having you on our next episode of 100 Days and Beyond. Thank you and goodbye.
Hi, everybody. This is Dudley again. And if you need help with a future or existing post-merger integration, I want to invite you to arrange a free, no-obligation meeting with us. During the meeting, we'll find out exactly what you need, what your challenges are, and we'll explain how our unique PMI slipstream method can help you. Simply call us or visit mergerintegration.co.uk. That's mergerintegration.co.uk, or come to our website, skillfulpursuit.com.